essentially aiding in all of the violations against human rights and the colonization of the Palestinian people. Now, practically, that means on the ground encouraging the further blockade of the people of Gaza, the siege that has been routinely put on them, the blockade that has lasted over 15 years, and the constant military attacks, of which often Israel uses as an opportunity to test and improve the weapons that they use to then use against other people across the world. We know that Israel has already used cameras, surveillance cameras, as already you mentioned, to blackmail Palestinians because they are so advanced in that arena. And this project is going to further add to that. But I think at the end of the day, when there are companies that many of us are forced into using, you know, it's often not a choice whether you use Google or Amazon because so many third-party platforms use them. It means that the weight and the size of the oppressors working against the Palestinians continues to increase. And as a result, we also have to increase our power, our grassroots power against them.
And Huda, can you tell us something about the apparent anti-BDS clause in the Project Nimbus contract?
Yeah, I mean, I think when you look at what BDS stands for, which is boycott, divestment and sanctions against the Israeli government to pressure them into complying with free demands, which include ending the colonization and occupation of Palestinian territories, including lifting the blockade of Gaza, for Palestinian refugees to have the right to return to their homes, which they were forced out of by Israel, and for Palestinian citizens to have equal rights as their Jewish counterparts. To have an anti-BDS clause is to go against those demands which are enshrined under international law and human rights conventions, and is to further perpetuate an apartheid system. So basically, by doing this, and by working with the Israeli military and government in the first place, Google and Amazon have basically called themselves advocates for apartheid and worse, against the Palestinian people.
David, what do you know about Ariel Curran, who resigned from Google over Project Nimbus?
Well, she was one of the people who objected to this activity. And there were quite a number. You saw 1,000 people there signed that letter. Quite a number of Jewish employees signed a separate letter complaining about the contract. And they've raised the issue of human rights abuses in all the ways that you would imagine. And of course, what happened was that these people were either sacked or were resigned. And so there's been a huge clear out there of people who would have any kind of critical view on the contract. And of course, inside Google itself, there are a number of others who are very supportive of this contract, but partly for business reasons, one would guess, but also partly there are those in there who are ideologically supportive of the Israeli government. And that's a significant problem for Google as a corporation.
No, indeed. I mean, and Huda, what kind of treatment has Palestine Action received from tech companies?
Well, from the start of Palestine Action, it became very clear that not only were we fighting a battle against Elbit, but we also had to find new ways to actually be able to get our words and our message out there, which was against an Israeli arms company. Within a month or two, Facebook had removed us after we were rapidly growing to 20,000 followers within a month or two. That followed by PayPal, DonorBox, Open Collective, many more liberal platforms as well removed us. And in the end, I think it's about 10 different tech companies and third-party platforms have removed Palestine Action or outright told us that we cannot use their platforms. And we actually discovered, I think after the seventh platform removed us, that it was because Elbit's lawyers were writing to them directly and that they were scared of a lawsuit and they were scared of going bankrupt. So basically, Elbit Systems, Israel's largest arms firm, were blackmailing, using legal warfare to blackmail companies into removing any support for our movement. But it has consistently failed to do so. And actually, the fact that they are forced into spending so much money on these lawyers to do so, I think is a testament the success of Palestine Action.
You know, David, the tech aspect of Israel's activities doesn't really get the attention it deserves, does it? I mean, how can that be combated?
Well, these are difficult stories to explain to people, I think. I mean, people understand human rights abuses. They understand direct support for human rights abuses from Zionist organisations and their activities in this country and the US, for example. But trying to understand the technicalities of tech, if you like, of Google, of Amazon, of Twitter, is difficult for people. And also, they don't see the inside of these companies. So the fact that there are huge numbers of people who are from Israeli intelligence organizations inside the social media companies, people don't get that, they don't understand that, they don't know about that. So I think partly the question is how you explain this story to people, how you explain the strategy which is being used by the State of Israel to penetrate tech companies so that they will be supportive of the human rights abuses conducted by the State of Israel. So that's the key question, it seems to me, is to how you explain to people how tech is a useful and interesting way to look at the abuses caused by the State of Israel.
Yeah, and say a little bit about this Unit 8200, which people will have heard about, I'm sure, but may not be totally familiar with what it is. Can you just give a little bit of background briefly before
Unit 8200 is an Israeli intelligence organisation, so people will be familiar with Mossad, which is like the equivalent of the CIA or MI6 in the UK. But Unit 8200 is like the GCHQ, is the signals intelligence, this is surveillance intelligence organization. It's part of military intelligence, it's part of the IDF, and they are engaged in the huge amount of surveillance there is of Palestinians. What we've been talking about just now, the attempt to surveil Palestinians, to spy on them, to gather compromise on them, to gather information about which can be used to blackmail them, to stop them joining the resistance or to make them informers. There's a huge amount of activity there, and these people are leaving this organisation and going into something like Google or Twitter, and that's really quite scary.
No, indeed. I mean, interesting, of course. Sir Keir Starmer appointed a former Unit 8200 operative to head up the Labour Party's social media activities. But we'll just have to pause there for a moment to have this report on how Israel lobby groups and former Zionist intelligence operatives are active in relation to Google.
Google's integration with the Israel military has been a steady development in which several key Israeli lobby groups have played an active role. Firstly, a group of employees within Google, which calls itself the Juglers, has been accused of driving right-wing ideologies and actively surveilling Arab and Muslim employees. The group successfully forced Google management to apologize for a donation it gave to the Movement for Black Lives Coalition on the basis that groups within the coalition had stated their solidarity with Palestinians. Another key entanglement Google has had with Israeli intelligence came with the founding of a tech hub by the name Team8. The CEO and co-founder is Nadav Zafrer, former commander of the infamous Signals Intelligence Unit 8200 in the Israeli military. Team8 was co-founded with Eric Schmidt, who at the time was executive chairman of Google.
Believe it or not, in all the years that I've worked with Israeli companies, this is my first physical visit here.
Really?
And I now understand why everybody was so excited about the country. Yeah. You know, it really is startup nation.
Yeah,
and for the stuff that I do, it's like the perfect positive storm.
Yeah.
You know, the sum of the educational system, the way the military works.
It's the curse into the blessing.
Well, no, but you may not appreciate how significant an advantage it gives you, because you're used to it, right? You live it. But it's notably different from any other country. You really feel it.
Israel lobby group, the Anti-Defamation League, is a select contributing member of YouTube's Trusted Flagger program, meaning that Google allows it to regulate content on the most used video service in the world. In a declassified FBI memo from 1969, it is questioned if the ADL, quote, represents a violation of the Foreign Agents Registration Act due to the, quote, extreme close ties between the ADL and Israel. Google is also a member of the ADL's Silicon Valley Anti-Cyber Hate Working Group. Another part of this integration has been the Startup Nation Central Organization set up by Republican donor Pauli Singer. The stated purpose of the organization is to combat BDS by feeding big tech jobs into Israel, but also by feeding Israeli workers into big tech companies. It's through organizations like Startup Nation Central that you have huge mass of former Israeli intelligence agents working inside Google today. A Mint Press investigation found there are at least 99 former Israeli Intelligence Unit 8200 personnel currently working inside Google, many of them working in very sensitive positions in the company. No doubt the Juglers lobby group will include them amongst their number. Some include Gavriel Gordel, who from 2010 to 2016 worked in Unit 8200, analyzing intelligence data to understand patterns of hostile activists. Today, he's the head of strategy and operations at Google. Jonathan Cohen was a team leader at Unit 8200 and is today the head of insights, data, and measurement at Google. The list is long and dangerous. Today, Google stands as a technological weapon against Palestinian liberation.
David, what do you make of the tactics of this Juglers group within Google then?
Well, it seems to be a kind of unofficial Zionist lobby group, doesn't it? And of course, as a speculation in the film there, presumably many of the people who are in or who were in Unit 8200, the Israeli intelligence organization, are part of the Juglers group. And they've been, you know, they attacked and have been involved in the surveillance of Muslim employees of Google. But also, the key thing was the return of this donation to the Black Lives Matter Foundation, which is a truly extraordinary thing. It's part of this whole idea that is promoted by the ADL, who we saw in the film there, and indeed by similar lobby groups in the UK, like the Community Security Trust. The idea that it's only racism against the Jews which is important, that's the most important form of racism in the society, and we must not engage with groups like BLM in case they have, for example, supporters of Palestine amongst their supporters, which of course they do. So it's an attempt really to focus all attention of liberals on anti-Semitism as the key preeminent form of racism in the society, and to make sure we don't talk about anti-Black racism and certainly not about anti-Palestinian racism.
I mean, Huda, organisations like Team 8 and Stand Up Nation Central seem to be combating BDS by feeding figures from the Israeli Intelligence Corps, Unit 8200, into big tech companies. So, yet these outfits are relatively anonymous to most people. I mean, why do you think that is?
Well, I think it's almost slightly similar to Elbit, in the sense that these companies don't necessarily want the attention, and they shouldn't want the attention because they are aware that if people were completely exposed to it, it would be widely condemned and it wouldn't be allowed to happen in the first place. And so often you find that these companies stray away from public attention and operate more in the shadows, because by placing Unit 8200 officers into companies like Google, it's essentially infiltrating spaces which harvest a lot of data. You know, these are power hubs for data collection, of which there have been many scandals in the past. But now it means that our data, my data, or anyone else's data who works for the Palestinian people is exposed to people who have and may continue to work on behalf of the Israeli government in order to perpetuate its oppression against the Palestinian people. And obviously, this is not something which you would know when you use Google, because it's so widely known, or Amazon. And that's what makes it a dangerous and effective strategy that the Israeli military or these companies are trying to use in order to gain access to that data without people's knowledge.
David, the Anti-Defamation League, I mean, tell us a little bit about its history and why is its relationship with YouTube a cause for concern?
Well, the ADL, the Anti-Defamation League, has been in existence for over a century now, and it started up as a branch of the B'nai B'rith, one of the key international Zionist organisations. And from very, very early on, in fact, from the 1940s, from before the creation of the State of Israel, it's been engaged in spying on Arab Americans and attempting to work with the FBI to harass them and to convict them for crimes. So it's been doing this since the 1940s, and indeed in the the 80s and 90s, there were court cases against it where it was revealed that it had been spying on thousands and thousands of activists, left-wing and liberal activists, including anti-apartheid activists in the case of South Africa. And it was actually selling data that it had collected from its spying operations directly to the apartheid regime in South Africa. So this is an organisation which is effectively an implement, an instrument against the left, which poses as being an anti-racist organisation. Mm. And it's very similar in a way to the Community Security Trust in the UK, which does similar stuff here, spies on the left. Indeed. Now, it's worrying because they are also, because they pose as liberals, they have access to, you said YouTube, but also to the Twitter safety panel and to many other social media companies' safety panels. So, and this is the case not just with the ADL in the US, but with the CST in the UK, with Le Crif in France. The Zionist organisations are able to moderate and help to moderate content on social media companies in a way that no Muslim organisation, and certainly no Palestinian organisation, is able to do. So there's a fundamental imbalance here, even if we leave out of account the former intelligence operatives who work inside the companies. We have Zionist organisations helping them to take decisions.
Mm. I mean, Huda, organisations like Team 8 and Startup Nation Central seem to be combating BDS by feeding figures from the Israeli intelligence court, Unit 8200, into big tech companies. Yet these outfits are relatively anonymous to most people. I mean, why do you think that is?
It's disgusting, and I think the timescale says a lot that this happens. Their promotion happened after the Project Nimbus had started. He became head of strategy in October 2022. And I mean, I think in general, the fact that anyone had a job for harvesting data on hostile activists is a bit of a strange term to use in the first place. But it shows that and I think Ariel, a former Google worker, has said this, that in the past few years, it's become clear from inside Google that there is an institutional Zionist bias. And I don't think it's a coincidence that many of these former Unit 1800 officers have been entering Google in those few years at the same time. So I think we're seeing a steady increase in the fact that Google is going to be used as another tool for the Zionist project. And in all, Israel has created an economy based on the domination of the Palestinian people. And I think what we're seeing here in general is these companies are trying to cash in on that colonization and oppression of the Palestinian people. And as long as we allow that to continue, we're going to see more and more powerful big tech companies, which normal people across the world are using day to day, also cashing in on that oppression.
David, I mean, what would you say the significance of this chap, Eric Schmidt's relationship is with Israel?
Well, I mean, you saw a little bit of the clip there with him with Benjamin Netanyahu from some years ago. And if you've watched the whole clip, it's really quite vomit-inducing, this obsequiousness. And I mean, saying to Netanyahu, I'm not sure you realise, Benjamin, just how fantastic your country is. And specifically mentioning the military, you know, nobody in the world who's ever had any attention to the media would be unaware of the horrific war crimes committed by the IDF day and daily, and the ongoing abuses that we see on television news every night. Even on the mainstream news, we see these things, never mind on alternative sources. So that's a significant issue. Now, I mean, with this the question of what he said there, but also, of course, as shown in the film, the involvement in various startup firms, which amongst which are those which help to bring people from the high tech into the high tech industry from the Israeli military, the Israeli government, and indeed even from Israeli companies. So that attempt to bring people together from Israel into the West and vice versa is an attempt, you know, in the end to increase the support for Zionism.
Well, I'm afraid we are going to have to leave it there. We're out of time. So that's it for today's show. I hope you found the programme informative again. Thanks to our guests, Huda Amori, and our resident expert, of course, Professor David Miller. And thank you for joining us today. We'll be back next week with more investigations and analysis on Palestine Declassified. So until next time, this is Chris Williamson saying bye for now.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really in fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing of our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. You're listening to the program Islamic Upbringing. In this program, we discuss your queries regarding the upbringing of your children. The answers are based upon the Noble Quran and the narrations of Prophet Muhammad, may peace be upon him and his purified progeny. Today in our studio, we have with us our guest speaker, Brother Miqdad. He's an Islamic researcher in the Hawza Ilmiya of Qom. Assalamu alaikum, brother.
Wa alaikum salam wa rahmatullah.
A very warm welcome.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for accepting the invitation. Well, Brother Miqdad, in our previous sessions, we have been talking about the dangers the animation and screens carry with them and how parents need to be aware of that, how children need to be aware of that, and how can parents save their children from all those dangers. We talked about one of the dangers that was worldview that's being portrayed through these animations and the games, video games basically. So what else, what are the other dangers?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. So yes, we've been talking about bringing an awareness to parents and youths about the dangers that video games and animations and serials can pose to our faith, to our values and our principles and lives. And we need to be concerned about just being freely watching and being fed by everything that comes from the screen. We need to be aware and know what's happening so that we can be at least be on guard. A person who is on guard, a person who filters the information that comes through to him or her, is going to be much more careful, much more wise in what they intake. And this is, inshallah, something we hope that all the listeners, inshallah, will take on board. We talked about changing worldview. And the second thing that we want to talk about today is how animations or serials or video games bring about role models in our lives, especially role models for children.
Mm-hmm.
And this is extremely dangerous. So a role model is a person. It can be a person. It can be either a real person or either an imaginary person.
Okay.
That is something or someone that we respect, that we admire. And because of this admiration for this person, it leads us towards that which they have. That perfection which that they have is something that we aspire towards, that we are driven by. So when you have a role model, you want to be like them, right? You want to change yourself to be like that, because what they have in terms of perfection, that you count that as a perfection, it's not necessarily true to be a perfection, but you count that as a perfection. Therefore, you want that for yourself, and therefore you're driven towards that perfection which this person has.
Okay.
And therefore you aspire towards that and you want to become to that. And therefore, role models are often the goal towards which we kind of take our life towards. So in our lives, we want to achieve something. We want to aspire towards something. And that is usually something that is manifested in this role model that we have, who has that perfection.
Yeah.
In Islam, this concept has been talked about many times in the Holy Quran as well as in our hadith. So the Holy Prophet is the best of role model, because the Holy Prophet has true human perfection. And therefore, this is something
azim,
that we aspire towards.
Yeah. He has akhlaq azim. He's got the best of the ethics, morals.
Exactly. So we aspire towards that. We're driven towards that. And if we follow the footstep and really are attracted towards that, then inshallah we too can become like the Holy Prophet. And this being a path for our life, or this being a goal for our life, is a very good goal, because that which the Prophet has is in reality a true human perfection.
Exactly. Well, we talked about the worldview, and another danger was the role models that these animations are bringing. We'll talk more on that after a short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned to IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio presents A Priceless Gift to Parents. Do you have problem with your kids?
I have two boys. One is 5-year-old and the other one is 3.5. And they constantly fight and wrestle with each other, and it often gets to a dangerous stage.
My 18-month-old daughter has learned to eat by herself, and she just refuses that I feed her. But usually, all the food basically goes everywhere except her mouth. So how can we allow this strife to happen for the purpose of freedom?
Don't worry. We're here to help.
For a child, the purpose of the food is only to feed. It's also for him to learn. It's also for him to explore and fulfill the need of curiosity, fulfill the need of freedom.
Islamic upbringing. Contact us. EnglishRadio@irib.ir.
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Islamic upbringing. I'm with Brother Miqdad, and we're talking about the dangers that the animation world, that the screens, that the video games are bringing with them. Yes, Brother Miqdad.
So, once we understand that there's a true perfection, that this perfection is embodied by a human being or an imaginary role model, this person becomes a role model, and therefore we're driven and aspire towards that. Now, what animations or movies or serials or video games do is that they bring forward for us a role model, for us or for our children, a role model. Yeah. And what happens is that they take this individual to be having a perfection that they are driven towards, that they want to become like. So, for example, to give you a couple of examples. One example is Emma in Frozen, right? Emma is a role model for many people. And how this is created as well, you find this is very clear. What happens is that the animation comes out, and with it comes a huge level of marketing, whether it's bags, whether it is posters, whether it is everything related to this theme of Frozen.
Yeah.
And so Emma becomes a role model. Now, what is that perfection that Emma has? What drives people towards Emma? Or towards what do you think a girl will see in Emma that is perfect, and that will then change her mindset to be like, I want to be like her.
All right.
In most cases, it can be her beauty. Right?
All right.
And her beauty is portrayed by a body image that's pretty much impossible for any real girl to achieve.
All right.
According to research, you find that either 1% or 2% of the population can actually achieve this body
image.
Model-like
body image.
Body image that's portrayed on TV.
Okay.
Right? That's first. Secondly, it's not a human perfection at all. Right?
Okay. She's,
the human perfection that is being given to her is an imaginary human perfection. Right?
Yeah.
The physical beauty that we have is not a true perfection we need to be aspired towards or spend out. And you find that a lot of girls will go through severe diet, will go through severe mental depression or anxiety because of being affected by this idea that I need to be in a certain way in terms of my physical body, in terms of my physical image. So this is driven by having role models that kind of have that. Now, this is Emma is an example. You can go across the board and see so many different examples of this where a role model is portrayed in its physical beauty.
Yeah.
Right. And this, obviously, it leads to so much detrimental effects in terms of their mental health, in terms of their physical health, etc. And generally, it brings about a wrong worldview in terms of what is true human perfection. Another thing that Emma could, for example, could portray is going against the norm. Now, for those who've watched Frozen, you know that she's hiding something, that she has something in her that she wants to kind of control, but The solution is not to hide it. The solution is not to be shy about it. The solution is to openly say it. Explore it. Openly say it. Don't be shy of it.
Doesn't matter if it breaks your norms.
Exactly.
All right.
And for those who watch it, you know what that is. Inshallah, I don't want to go through it right now.
All right. So we talked about that these animations or these video games or films can bring something that can, you said, the role models. Another danger was role models. And those role models could bring so many things with them, like body image and imaginary human perfection, and like going against norms. We'll talk more on that after a short break, dear listeners. Stay tuned to IRIB English Radio. يا مقضي الخيرات يا
مقضي الخيرات The Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam said, No father has granted a gift to his child better than good manners. يا مقضي الخيرات يا مقضي الخيرات يا
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Islamic Upbringing. I'm with Brother Mikhtar, and we are talking about the dangers of screen animation, video games, and things like that. Yes, brother.
So another example, again, Emma was an imaginary example. Another imaginary example is Khan. So Marvel came out with this new superhero called Khan, a Pakistani a Muslim girl who has superpowers.
Okay.
They, according to themselves, they made this Marvel superhero to attract and to bring on board
Muslim girls.
Muslims and Asian population, basically.
Okay.
So Khan, again, she doesn't wear hijab. She drinks. And obviously her level of religiosity when it comes to true religion, she just is a Muslim by name. And she's Asian as well. She's Pakistani. She speaks Urdu. She carries books, that Islamic books in her hand. She has Islamic books, but obviously she doesn't practice any of the religion that we need to practice. This Khan, as a superhero, is now a role model for girls today.
All right.
So girls today see her as what we need to aspire to become, right? That girl who's outgoing, who's a superhero, who's an amazing person. I want to be like her. What does it mean to be like her? It means to have the characteristics that she has, none of which are Islamic, none of which are to do with our religion. She has relationships outside of marriage. She has no hijab, no concept of hijab, etc. She's supporting the American values that are out there.
Okay.
Basically brainwashing children to take that as a goal in life, and that and those values and principles that come with it. So you can see how this is dangerous when it comes to having that as a role model.
All right.
We can carry on with the list. So these were just two kind of examples from animations, but even in the real world, so actors have come across and become real role models. So Emma Watson, for example.
All right.
Or for example, this actress, for example, who goes to Africa and adopts different children, orphans from Africa. She now has more than 3 or 4. I can't remember. I lost count. And so people count that as an amazing act of charity where she goes to Africa, adopts children who have been suffering from war, etc. She now becomes a role model, basically.
Celebrity whitewashing, we must say.
All right. And how this leads us then to move away from our religion, move away from reality, is something that we need to really think about.
All right. So we actually got to think about like what is being portrayed. We have to analyze it very, very deeply to get an idea about the worldviews that are being portrayed to us. Thank you so much, Brother Mikhtar, for being with us. Thank you so much, dear listeners. You were listening to IRIB English Radio. Until another session, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Do you know what Islam says? It says that life's the greatest test. It says that life's a borrowed space, returned upon rest. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a problems. Allah leaves no stone unturned. Perfect with no flaws at all are the laws of Allah.
Join us in this journey. IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
انسان را مطمئن می کند ذکر خدا ذکر الله تطمئن القلوب.
Be aware, the hearts find rest in Allah's remembrance.
Spring of truth. This is a part of political divine will of the founder of Islamic Republic of Iran, Imam Khomeini. The Muslim community must never neglect Friday prayer, one of the greatest blessings of Allah, the Exalted, which is best performed in the Islamic Republic of Iran. They should also not neglect the mourning ceremonies for the infallible imams, especially for the leader of the oppressed and the most prestigious of the martyrs, His Holiness Imam Hussein, alayhi salam. May peace and blessings of Allah, His Prophet, His angels, and the righteous be upon His great and brave soul.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah, dear listeners. Thank you so much for joining us today on the new episode of Spring of the Truth from IRIB English Radio. I'm Sister Mousavi, and in this new episode, we will make an effort to shed some light on the precious words and sayings of Imam Khomeini, rahmatullah alayh. In one of his speeches, he says that real knowledge is the light of guidance of the heaven, and the straight path of proximity to God and the door of His generosity. You know, this precious sentence raises three points. First of all, it talks about real knowledge that leads us to heaven. And not every type of knowledge has got such a quality. Not every type of knowledge leads us to salvation, and it is just the real knowledge. And as a lover of Imam Khomeini, rahmatullah alayh, my interpretation of real knowledge is the religious knowledge that helps one to come to know better himself or herself, as well as his or her creator. And this type of knowledge leads us to a considerable change of viewpoints about every single aspect of life, and especially the mortality of life in this world. Now let's just have a break and we'll be back in no time and talk about other points about this sentence. Well, there are some points about this verse that we will talk about after having a short break. I wanted to raise this point that knowledge is one of the most efficient ways of getting closer to God. This sentence implies God's love of knowledge in a way that it is used as an opportunity for us as human beings to get closer and closer to God. So knowledge could be seen as a means of salvation, as a means of getting closer to God. And that's quite an opportunity if we as servants of Allah be wise and smart in this regard. And the third point is that it leads to Allah's generosity. You know, again, it signifies the importance and vitality of knowledge for human beings, that Allah will provide His knowledgeable servants with His rahmah or generosity. The point is that this generosity might include not only materialistic provision, but also moral supplies, which make the subject even more significant. So we can see the importance of knowledge, and especially the knowledge that connects one to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, and hence the fruitful results of such a connection. Well, for the ending, let's just read the sentence again. Imam Khomeini, rahmatullah alayh, says that real knowledge is the light of guidance of the heaven and the straight path of proximity to God and the door of His generosity.
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله.
Every night and every day, never forget to say لا إله إلا.
Discovering Islam. The story of Tawheed is not limited to the creation of the world or oneness of God. Another important aspect of Tawheed is that we have to worship the one and only God. But why should we worship God? What is the purpose of worship? Why should we worship a God who does not benefit from our worshiping? And why is worshipping anything beside or in association with God the greatest sin according to the Quran? Man is a worshipping being and cannot be free from worship in one form or another. If we do not worship God, we worship other things, even including our ideas, our aspirations, or our desires. The moment we cease to worship, our life is disrupted.
The word
word in Arabic for worship is Aliha, which is used in the phrase La ilaha illallah. The word Aliha actually means a number of things. It means to worship. It also means to be obsessed with. It also means to rely on someone in time of need. It also means to be in love with someone. It also means, continuing the idea of obsession, to not be able to think of anyone else. To feel or to miss someone intensely when they're not present. And so when we say La ilaha illallah, we are saying there's no one worthy of worship or of love, of obsession, of reliance. No one worthy of me turning to them in time of desperation and need other than Allah.
Tawheed in worship is one of the most important aspects of Tawheed. For it's not a matter of belief anymore, but a matter of action as well. It shows how committed one is in their faith. It is the manifestation of the soul and heart of a believer in their practice.
Worship in action includes that your intention, you have to have ikhlas, which means pure sincerity for the sake of God. Not your ego, not to please others, not to please society, but to please the one that created you.
Worship is to adore, to praise, and to humble oneself towards the object of worship. The Quran states that some people take their fleeting desires as the objects of their worship.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitan rajeem. Afara'ayta man ittakhadha ilahahu hawa. Have you seen the one who takes his own base desire as his Lord? So associating partners to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is not only worshipping an idol. The individual might worship his own lower self. When I'm obeying other than Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, that can be my nafs. That itself is a form of shirk. As we know, we have two different types of shirk. The first type is shirk al-khafi. Shirk al-khafi is the hidden shirk. And the second type is shirk al-jali. It is the apparent one. The apparent one is the person in the temple worshipping, if he's truly worshipping the idol. But the khafi one, the hidden one, the minor shirk, is me taking my lower desire, taking the power, taking the position, taking my wealth as my Lord. And both of these types of shirk takes me to destruction, because it's taking me away from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
All human beings are bound to worship something. It is in our nature to worship. The only thing is, are we picking the right authority, or the Quranic word is ilah, or God, to worship? Quran actually details a few false gods. For example, Hawa, the god of desire. So if we were to become ibad, or servants of desire, what would happen to us? We would be destroyed. We would have self-destruction. We would not be able to live our lives in the best way possible. So it is indeed our nature to worship something, and our best interest to worship Allah.
You have people who are free of the worship of God, who free themselves of the worship of the Creator. However, that's not to say that it's not replaced by the worship of something else. So you see people who don't worship God end up worshiping earthly pleasures, they end up worshiping money or power, they end up having addictions which become like a kind of worship because there is such a strong dependence on them. So man can free himself of worship of God's, man can free himself of God's worship simply because he has the free will to do so. However, that's not to say that it's a choice without consequence.
In our day-to-day experience, we can see how sometimes we are humbled to and infatuated by our desires. This is because realizing those desires is very important to man. And thus, he is prepared to humble himself before anything that may help him to bring about what he wants and to realize his desires. And this is probably how idol worshiping came about.
Idol worship is an aberration of the heart and mind. Idol worship is essentially the ego, because I think all idol worship stems from self-worship. Because there's going to be an element where you're going to be worshiping your ego, because your ego is that veil that prevents you from seeing the truth.
People used to worship idols because they thought they controlled the sources of what they sought. If they wanted a child or money or victory or good harvest, there was a God for each of them who could fulfill their need. It was sheer material need which made them to turn to God. And since God was so transcendent, they sought more immediate deities to talk to.
Many people find it very difficult to understand a transcendental God, a God that is everywhere, but at the same time so far away from us, a God who's all-powerful, but we're so impotent, a God who is living everywhere, but we will die, a God who is powerful to do anything, yet we can struggle to do anything. When there is that very big gap between where we are and where God is, there feels that there needs to be some sort of intermediary to get there. And that is where this idea of idol worship happens. And the idea that they can worship someone who acts as a mechanism to get to the purest God.
The big question is, why has God placed this sense of worship in man? Why are we instructed to worship Him? Is He in need of us worshiping Him?
Well, I would never want to worship a God that actually benefits from me. That would mean God is not God anymore. It means He's weak, He's needy. God's name is the free. Al-Ghani, He's free, He's independent, He's self-subsisting. That deserves to be worshipped.
Fundamental to the conception of God in Islam and in the Quran is that He is independent. He is needless. Huwa al-Ghani. The verse continues, Wa antumul fuqaraha. You are the needy. You are the dependent. So God does not need our worship whatsoever.
وَمَا خَلَقْتُ الْجِنَّ وَالْإِنسَ إِلَّا لِيَعْبُدُونَ. How should we interpret this verse in the Quran, which states that God has not created jinn and human being, but to worship Him?
Some people misunderstand this ayah and think God just wants us to just be praying to Him all the time and do nothing else, just pray, because we have no other purpose in life. Actually, all the other things, like, it's the same God who said, وَجَعَلْنَا لَكُمْ فِيهَا مَعَايِشَ. He put on the earth things for you to live well. He wants you to live well in this world. He wants you to dress well, eat well, sleep well, have a nice family, enjoy yourselves. He wants those things for you. And guess what? When you do them, you are actually fulfilling a command of Allah by utilizing the things He made for you.
People sometimes make objections as to why, if God does exist, He needs to be worshipped. Surely if God exists, He is free of any such need. Why do we have such a needy God who needs to be constantly told that He's right, that needs to be constantly told that He's great? However, really the truth is that, of course, God doesn't need to be worshipped at all. And we don't worship God because it is in any way adding to His being or taking away from it if we are not worshipping Him. We worship God because we need to worship God. Because we need to have a sense of grounding and a sense of direction. We worship God as a reminder of who put us on this earth, as a reminder of why we are here, and as a reminder of where we will ultimately end up. If we didn't remind ourselves of God and of His existence every single day, we would very soon forget. And then where would we be? We would be completely lost.
Thus, the only meaning that we can imagine for this verse is that worship brings us closer to Him, and by Him we mean the absolute perfection.
If I want to get closer to perfection, or if I want to become perfect myself, I need to take this perfection or these attributes from the source of perfection.
Worshipping God is nothing to do with Him. requiring it. God is considered to be ghani. He is needless of any of our worship. But at the same time, it is us who need that worship. We need this opportunity to really excel in this life. Why? Because that will help us in the hereafter, and it will help other people in this world. And that's the core essence of why we are here. We need to have this opportunity to excel.
So what is the purpose in this worship? The purpose in this worship is nothing more than for humankind's benefit, to help humankind move towards those pinnacles of existence and to take on those godlike qualities in their life.
The famous verse which states that God only created man and jinn to worship him clearly states that the aim of the creation is the journey towards God. And let's be reminded that God is the source of all perfection. Hence, the conclusion is, this life is about worshipping Him, i.e. is about taking this journey towards perfection.
There remains another essential question here. How should we worship God? Are rituals enough as worship?
Ritual performance is nothing if it isn't a means towards godliness and goodliness. And we see this throughout the Quran. Worship in its truest sense is servitude towards God, to become as God would like one to be. This isn't done through the performance of any ritual. Rituals are purely instrumental.
Worship means obedience. Worship means submission to the will of God. Worship does not mean that you should constantly sit in the direction of Mecca and continue to pray and pray and pray. As long as you are living your life according to the will of God and you're not disobeying, every single breath that you're taking is worship.
Too often we talk about worship solely in terms of ritual. We talk about worship solely in terms of doing things. Whereas worship in itself is the remembrance of God as God should be remembered. It is the remembrance of God in a way that reminds us of His greatness. And if what we are doing, whatever ritual we are performing, is not reminding us of the greatness of God, then really it is not an act of worship, it is mere ritual.
In other words, anything we do in this world in remembrance, love, and obedience of God can be regarded as an act of worship.
To summarize it is to love God, to obey Him, and to worship Him. And that translates in many things. Praying 5 times a day, doing dhikr, which is the remembrance of God. Actually being in service to your fellow human beings is also a form of worship if you're doing it for the sake of God. And that's worship in action in a way, when you're doing actions like serving others and giving acts of charity. Because we believe the acts of worship, but the only true worship if you do it for the sake of God.
Worship is an evolving process. And when one worships with an understanding of what God is, one always has to work towards perfection.
So our ritual fasts and prayers are not the only acts of worship. Our love for our family and relatives, any help extended to fellow human beings, to win bread for our dependents, could as well be regarded as acts of worship.
A dhikr is remembrance. Look at the signs. Look at what is around you. And you will get the feeling that He is with you even though you don't see Him. And the final step, which is excellence, al-ihsan, is to worship Him as if you are seeing Him. But how? Out of love. In kuntum tuhibbun Allah. Worshipping is to love, is not only to abide by the rules. You abide by the rules because you love. And you show your love because you abide by the rules. So it's a virtuous cycle, and this is the meaning of worshiping.
Apart from the acts we offer as worship, worship has an essence.
Its essence is based on placing one's hope and fear in God alone.
Tawheed in worship means that the type of humility, obedience, fear, and hope offered to God should not be offered to anyone and anything else. This is the path to man's perfection because it emancipates human.